two Sundays ago, when I finished message number 12 in the series Jesus Was Right About Everything, Joe came up here after I was done to lead a closing song, and he said, that was a great conclusion to the series. I'm not sure if he heard me wrong earlier in the week when I said that I was thinking of making that the last message in the series, or it was just his way of suggesting that it might be time to move on. But I haven't been able to shake this feeling that we're not quite done with this. I've actually got two more messages in me on this theme, so I hope that you will indulge me and let me get them out. As you know, I've had two basic goals during this series. The first is to repeat the truth that Jesus was right about everything so many times that you will never forget it. And that, in fact, it will shape your thinking on every significant subject about which you will form an opinion for the rest of your life. And by now, you know the logic of this statement. Jesus was right about everything because he was God. That makes him different than everybody else. Everybody else who has an opinion about anything was not God. Jesus was God, so he was right. It's not rocket science, right? It's just a very simple idea. And that can help us so much to kind of reduce the complexity of our life and try to figure out, you know, how we should think about all the different stuff that's happening all around us. But then my second goal in the series was to see what Jesus had to say about those specific issues that were most important to him and those issues that are most important to us. Admittedly, some of the issues we've covered were more important to him than they are to some of us. But we've also talked about some issues that are more important to us than they seem to have been to him. But today, we're going to talk about an issue that was as important to Jesus as it is to us. And the issue is how to achieve success in life. Now, we may not realize how important that issue is to us because of the language we use to describe the kind of success we want. See, we all have our own ambitions, or aspirations, or goals, or dreams, whether we want wealth, or fame, or power, or prestige, or influence, or admiration. See, we just want to fulfill our potential. We want to achieve excellence. We want to climb as high as possible. We all would love to have a standing room only crowd at our funeral. We want the world to be different because we showed up. You see all the different ways that we describe this basic human instinct to be great at something. Actually, that was the word that Jesus used, greatness. We all aspire to greatness, however we define it. We may not feel like we're there yet. We may feel like we will never get there. But the fact is that from birth to death, we long to matter. And Jesus never tried to snuff out that fire in his followers. What he did instead was to point them in the right direction, to help them to stop going down dead-end roads, and to pursue greatness that would not only fulfill them in this life, but that would also survive the transition from this life to the next life, so that they would be considered great in heaven, as hard as that is to imagine. And here's the really encouraging thing. The greatness that Jesus taught us to pursue is accessible to everyone, because it's not dependent on your age or your education or your intelligence or your Enneagram or your health or your luck or your race, or your gender, or your past, or anything else that you think limits your opportunities or your potential. You can be as great as you choose to be. Why do you think the first disciples of Jesus were so eager to follow him? I'm sure there are all kinds of different motivations, but one of the common denominators in the stories that the Gospels include is the motive of ambition. Whether it was Nathanael imagining what it would be like to be associated with the one around whom angels would orbit, or Simon, Andrew, James, and John leaving behind the obscurity of a career as fishermen to help fill the nets of God's kingdom with people. Or Matthew, jumping at the chance to shed his past and become part of the Messiah's inner circle. See, they all had this fire in their belly to do and to be something great. And when Jesus affirmed Peter's confession that he was indeed the Messiah, the one anointed by the Spirit of God to reign as King of the world forever, it just stoked those inner flames. But no sooner did Jesus confirm his identity than he told his disciples that he was going to die in Jerusalem rather than rule there. And then he was going to rise from the dead, whatever that meant. Peter rebuked Jesus for being such a pessimist, upon which Jesus rebuked him for his short-sighted, earthbound perspective. And then came the transfiguration. Imagine what that was like for those who saw it, beholding Jesus in his blindingly bright, glorified state was like a preview of coming attractions. He told the three disciples who were there not to tell anyone what they had seen until after he rose from the dead. Again, they had no clue what that meant. But nonetheless, adrenaline rushed through them as they thought about what the glorification of Jesus would mean for them. And then Jesus repeated what he had said earlier. He said, "I'm going to die and rise again." And both Mark and Luke wrote that the disciples did not understand what he meant, and they were afraid to ask him about it. Why do you think that was? I think it was because the ambitions that they had as assistants to the Messiah could only be realized if the Messiah stayed alive. It's clear that they were more focused on their future than on his, because the very next paragraph in Mark and Luke say that immediately after this, as they were walking along the road, they argued with one another about which of them would be the greatest, presumably in the kingdom that Jesus was going to establish. And they were talking behind Jesus' back, and they thought he wasn't listening. But Mark says that when they arrived at their destination, he asked them, "What were you arguing about on the road?" And no one answered because they didn't want to admit that they had argued about which of them was the greatest. Sitting down, Jesus called the 12 and said, "Anyone who wants to be first must be the very last and the servant of all." That's Jesus' word to every ambitious disciple. The way up is down. We do not achieve greatness by outpacing our competitors, but by letting them win, by helping them to win, by striving to come in last. Notice that Jesus did not criticize ambition. He just redirected it. See, their goal was to climb the ladder of success, and his advice was to go down rather than up. And if right now you're thinking, "Yeah, okay, but..." then you have a lot in common with the apostles. I think it's safe to say that they didn't get it. How do I know that? Well, I know it because this same scenario played out over and over again. They just never got on the same page as Jesus. Mark 10 describes Christ's third prediction of his death and resurrection. "We are going up to Jerusalem," he said, "and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him, flog him, and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise." Could Jesus have been any more clear? And yet, Luke tells us the disciples did not understand any of this. Why not? Because they had a one-track mind. The very next verse in the Gospel of Mark says, "Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. 'Teacher,' they said, 'we want you to do for us whatever we ask.'" "What do you want me to do for you?" he asked. They replied, "Let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory." Ambitious men, those two. But Jesus said, "You don't know what you're asking. Can you drink the cup I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with? Now stop and think about that. They want to be way up at the top of the org chart, just one level below Jesus. And Jesus says, are you willing to get there the same way I get there? And they said, absolutely. We can drink the cup you drink. We can be baptized with the same baptism that you are baptized with. And Jesus said to them, you will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with. And if they had known what that meant, it would have scared all the ambition out of them. But to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared. Now, look at the next verse. When the ten heard about this, they became indignant with James and John. Why? Well, because those two guys were angling to lock up the positions that they wanted. So here we go again. Jesus called them together and said, you know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. Again, notice, it's not the wanting to be great that is the problem. The problem is that they were aiming at the wrong target. They were thinking in terms of their earthly stature rather than eternal honor. And listen, you have to decide which one you want, greatness on the dot or greatness on the line, greatness in your earthly life or greatness in your eternal life, because the paths to each go in opposite directions. If you want earthly greatness, aim high. But if you want eternal greatness, go low. In the long term, the way up is down. Heavenly success is achieved through earthly service. And then Jesus told them that this was the path to greatness, even for him. For even the Son of Man did not come, Son of Man is Jesus, that's him talking about himself. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. So, the lower you go, the higher you rise. In fact, it is only when service leads to self-sacrifice, actually to suffering, that you can reach your full potential. Not long after Jesus said that, he rode a donkey colt into Jerusalem. We call it the triumphal entry. But what a strange way to put greatness on display. He could have mounted a white horse, as he will when he returns. But there he was, the Messiah, the King of Kings, on a donkey so small that his feet almost touched the ground. In Jerusalem, Jesus said that the time of his death was near, and then he said, whoever serves me must follow me, and where I am, my servant will also be. He or she will go down with me and then go up with me. And as he was teaching in the temple on the week before his death, Jesus acknowledged the prevailing cultural perspective on greatness, modeled by the religious leaders. He said, everything they do is done for people to see. They make their phylacteries wide and their tassels on their garments long. They love the place of honor at banquets and the most important seats in the synagogues. They love to be greeted with respect in the marketplaces and to be called rabbi by others. But you are not to be called rabbi, for you have one teacher, and you are all brothers. And do not call anyone on earth father, for you have one father, and he is in heaven. Nor are you to be called instructors, for you have one instructor, the Messiah. Now look at this. The greatest among you will be your servant. For those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Once again, the way up is down. And then, on the night before his death, Jesus and his disciples gathered in that upper room to share one last supper. The Gospel of John says, Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. Who was the designated foot washer in that culture? The person in the room with the lowest status, typically a slave. That's why none of the disciples volunteered to do it. And that's why Jesus did. And when he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. "Do you understand what I have done for you?" he asked them. "You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. Very truly, I tell you, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things," look at this, "now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them." What does that mean? It means that serving is not only the path to greatness, it is also the secret to happiness. To be blessed means to feel deep down the pleasure of God. That's what those who pursue heavenly greatness get on earth. And what effect did this profound lesson have on the disciples? Well, we get a clue from what Luke tells us happened at the end of the meal. He said, "A dispute also arose among them as to which of them was considered to be greatest." So one last time, Jesus said, "Huddle up, listen. The kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who exercise authority over them call themselves benefactors. But you are not to be like that. Instead, the greatest among you should be like the youngest, and the one who rules like the one who serves. For who is greater, the one who is at the table or the one who serves? Is it not the one who is at the table? But I am among you as one who serves. I am the one who got up from the table and got down on my hands and knees to serve. I have modeled for you how to achieve greatness in the kingdom of God. The way up is down." And I still don't think it's sunk in, because when Jesus died, so did their dreams. It felt to them as if his plan for success in life was proven wrong. It cost him and them everything and got them nowhere. It really wasn't until after Christ's resurrection, when the same Spirit who filled him came upon them, that everything clicked. And the word service became holy to them. Today, we read passages in the New Testament that include that word, and we forget what a radical idea it was and still is, that the way up is down. I mean, when Paul said in 2 Corinthians 4, "What we preach is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, and ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake." I wonder if that really registers. And when he says in Galatians 5, "You, my brothers and sisters, were called to be free, but do not use your freedom to indulge the flesh. Rather, serve one another humbly in love." Do we realize how countercultural that is? And when Peter says, "Each of you should use whatever gift you have received to serve others as faithful stewards of God's grace in its various forms," does it occur to us that this is the same guy who once rebuked Jesus, now echoing what Christ taught about how to be great in the eyes of God? And the mindset that Peter tells church elders to have, to be shepherds of God's flock who are eager to serve, how different is that than the leaders who are celebrated in our culture? I don't think there's a better commentary on what Jesus taught about greatness than Philippians 2, where the Apostle Paul applies Christ's teaching to our everyday lives. He says, "Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of others. In your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus, who, being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing. By taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. So his plan did work, after all. Jesus became greater than anyone else, not by using his deity to his advantage, but by putting himself last and becoming the servant of all. He blazed a trail for us, and it is only by following his plan for success in life that we can reach our full potential. But I'm afraid that we are like the disciples, so slow to learn. At least I am. From day one of my Christian life, I was encouraged to dream big. I remember going to this conference when I was a brand new Christian. It was a retreat in the mountains. I was 20 years old, and I got this this brochure when I got to the conference, and on the cover it said, "Make a mark that's hard to erase," and there was a picture there of a fish symbol that was carved into a wooden desk, and it made my pulse race. It whispered to me that I could leave an indelible mark on the world. And everywhere I turned, I saw disciples of Jesus who seemed to be doing that. Best-selling authors, megachurch pastors, Christian pop stars, all being held up as role models. And they all insisted that they were surprised and humbled by their success, and that all they really cared about was being faithful to their calling. And so the message that I got was that God rewards humility and faithfulness with an ever-growing sphere of influence. I even found biblical teaching that seemed to say that. I was at another conference, a bigger conference, a lot more people in the audience. This guy was teaching the Bible to thousands of people, and he told us how he got the gig. He said, "Maybe you dream of speaking to an audience this size. Let me tell you my story. When I was in graduate school, I drove 3 hours every Sunday to preach at a little country church with 12 members. And little by little, God enlarged my responsibilities. First, I pastored a small church, then a larger church, and now, decades later, I get to speak at conferences like this." "Here's the principle," he said. "Whoever is faithful with little will also be faithful with much." That's what Jesus said in Luke 16. So if you are faithful with whatever God gives you to do now, he will entrust you with more significant responsibilities in due time. Whether that's exactly what he said or not, I'm not sure, but that's what I heard. And I took it as gospel truth. And that truth was reinforced by the trajectory of my mentors and my heroes in ministry. They all went from small to big. And for the first 20 years of my ministry, that was how my career was going. And then everything changed. In 2006, the church that I was pastoring in Southern California went through a very turbulent period that ended in a split. And it happened, as far as I could tell, despite my faithfulness. And my ministry borders started shrinking. And they kept shrinking until I left that church 4 years later. And then God clearly led me and my family here to a wonderful church family that has blessed us beyond descriptions. And I think that my reasons for coming were pure. But White Pine just happened to be a fraction of the size of the church that we left. Now, it's so important to me that you hear my heart. Being your pastor has been such a gift. Man, I just love this church family more than I can say. And I do not think that this church is insignificant. But part of me was still clinging to my old way of thinking about success. And I couldn't shake the question, why did I get downsized? And then it occurred to me that I was actually on the same trajectory as Jesus. I mean, think about his ministry. It didn't start small and get big. It started big and got small. There's a video called Jesus on Twitter, and it tracks how many followers he had. It shows the numbers go up fast during the miracle working and food multiplying and Pharisee blasting stage. And then there's a steady decline when he says things like, eat my flesh and drink my blood and hate your parents and sell your possessions and take up your cross. And then everybody bails when it becomes clear that he's going to get crucified. In the end, he had 12 followers, then 11, then none, save John and a few others at the cross. Even God the Father abandoned him. It wasn't until after Jesus died that his impact peaked. But that was Jesus. What about his followers? Well, let's see. John the Baptist got beheaded. So did James and Matthew and Paul. Peter and Andrew and Philip and Bartholomew were all crucified. Thomas was shot through with arrows. John was boiled in oil, but survived, only to die in exile. Now, this might be a no-brainer to you, but to me it was a revelation. There is not a single New Testament example of any follower of Jesus achieving anything resembling celebrity status. They were all downwardly mobile. They all died without achieving anything resembling greatness in a worldly sense. That's not what I signed up for. Well, actually, I did. I just didn't know it when Jesus said, follow me. I didn't know that he meant that literally. Not too long after I joined the staff at White Pine, a young woman came up to me after church and said that the Lord had given her a vision. And I asked her to tell me about it. And she said, I saw you doing something for somebody that no one noticed. And I said, well, I hope your vision was prophetic because that's the kind of person I want to be. I didn't say it out loud, but I knew I wasn't. I'm going to read to you an embarrassing entry from my journal dated February 18, 2013. On the way to my office this morning, which is in the basement of a 45-year-old brick rectangle, I passed the garbage collection truck on its Tuesday route. When I turned into our icy parking lot, I noticed that our trash was not on the street. If it did not get to the street by the time the truck came, it would either go in my trunk to be taken home, our trash is picked up on Thursday, or it would remain in the kitchen trash cans for another week, intensifying in odor and spilling over capacity. The trash had to be taken out. After rushing pizza boxes to the street, I came back and searched the building for the requisite orange trash bags, and then got on my hands and knees to stuff the trash into the bags. It occurred to me while I was down there that this is not where I expected to be at this point in my life. I came from a large church in Southern California where you had to go up the stairs, not down, to get to my office, and where we paid people to take out the trash. Then I opened my Bible and I read the story of Jesus being asked to pay the temple tax. Jesus, the one for whom the temple was built. Jesus, the one who had just descended from the Mount of Transfiguration. Jesus, the one who answers questions before they are asked. Jesus, the one who puts exact change in the mouth of a fish. If anyone had a right to tell the tax collectors where they could put their 2 drachmas, Jesus did. And yet his determination not to demand the respect he deserved was predictable because it was the consistent pattern of his life. Much as I long to rise, I am under the thumb of God, down, down, he presses me all the way down to where Jesus is. I haven't thought about that journal entry for a long time. But this past week in our staff meeting, I learned that Lois Gerke is moving out of the area. And that saddens me because she is a contagious and joyful Jesus follower, and she's a friend of mine. She also happens to be the one who has been quietly taking the church's trash out for several years. She took over for Charlie Clement, another saint, when he and Diane moved to Massachusetts. So in our staff meeting, we were problem solving. Someone has to take out the trash. And I sat there, and I watched Joe Campbell and Sarah Cass essentially argue with one another about which of them was going to take out the trash. They both wanted to volunteer to do it. And it occurred to me, I'm in the presence of greatness here. These are the people that Jesus said are great. And I'm surrounded by people like that, Sarah and Joe and Lois and Charlie and so many trash taker-outers at White Pine who have taught me how to follow Jesus. I am so grateful that I have a God who is so committed to helping me fulfill my potential that he uses his word and his people to lead me back onto his plan for greatness every time I'm distracted by the worldly alternative. You probably know by now how much I wrestled with whether or not to tell you about this struggle. Because I've been so afraid that you'll think, well, Greg only cares about numbers, not about us as people. And nothing could be further from the truth. White Pine's been the place where God has taught me to love people like never before. It's such a privilege to be one of your pastors. But obviously, I'm a work in progress. And I know that it may be hard for you to relate to my battle with pastoral ambition, but the world that you live in is not all that different than mine. You have that same fire in your belly, don't you? You want to be successful. You want to be all that you can be. But the ladder to success is crowded. You can't help but bump into a whole lot of other people in your quest for greatness. And that is by God's design, because it is how you relate to those people that will determine whether or not you reach your goal. It is not by stepping over them, but by lifting them up, by serving them, by valuing them above yourself, that you will become truly great in the eyes of God. That's what Jesus said. And that's how Jesus lived. And he was right about everything.